there, Paula Poundstone here. I hate to interrupt, but maybe you might like to listen to my new show, live from the Poundstone Institute, where I talk to researchers about interesting studies. It's like Hidden Brain, except our brains are really well hidden. Find it now on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. This week, we'll swing across the skies with Spider-Man Homecoming. Then, a talk about the very silly HBO sports mockumentary, Tour de Pharmacy. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's introduce the panel.
I'm Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write for the NPR website.
And in our fourth chair this week, the host of NPR's afternoon flagship news magazine, All Things Considered, and one of our favorite people in the building, Audie Cornish. Hi, Audie.
Hey there, Linda.
It's always so nice to have Audie
Thanks
in the room.
Thanks for having me.
Now, there's been no shortage of big-screen Spider-Man adaptations. Spidey was rebooted very successfully in 2002 with star Tobey Maguire and director Sam Raimi. It was then rebooted in 2012, less successfully, with star Andrew Garfield and director Mark Webb. But now Marvel is ready to marry its master of arachnoid adventure with the rest of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That meant that a new Spider-Man, played by Tom Holland, showed up in 2016 in Captain America: Civil War. Now, Spider-Man Homecoming, directed by John Watts and written by committee, gives Holland's Peter Parker his own playground adjacent to the ones the Marvel Cinematic Universe has been building since Iron Man in 2008. Here, Holland shares the screen with Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark, Marissa Tomei as Aunt May, and Michael Keaton as Vulture. Glenn, what are your Spider-Man feelings up to this point?
I certainly like the Tobey Maguire, mostly because of Raimi, Sam Raimi, the director. I thought the Andrew Garfields were fine, but unexceptional.
Yeah.
I think this, however, is how you friggin' do it. You lean into the comedy and you keep the scale small.
Yeah.
The reason this feels so fresh is that for the first time, we know in the real world, Spider-Man is Marvel's flagship character, the biggest gun that they have. But here, he's being treated as a C-lister. And that's the first time they could do that because up to now, he was alone in his universe. Now he is just a kid who is learning the ropes. And back when Iron Man 2 came out, I had this big grand theory that the reason Iron Man 2 didn't feel satisfactory is because it wasn't an origin story. And we love origin stories.
Yeah.
We need origin stories. That was back in the late Jurassic when Iron Man 2 came out, and much has changed. And here, we don't get the origin story, which I think is crucial, but we do get something that I think now might be the key. We get the training montage.
Sure.
He's learning the ropes. It doesn't matter where he got bit by the damn spider. What matters is he's a kid, and he's learning, and it works.
Yeah. Audie, I don't think of you as a person who loves every superhero movie, but I also don't...
I am discerning.
But I also don't think of you as a person who goes in against superhero movies. How did you react to this one?
Well, I did sit down to next to Glenn in the theater, and I said, I'm here under duress, because I have felt so much like I don't need another Spider-Man. It's not that I don't like this story. I just didn't need another one. And by the end of it, they had totally turned it around for me and totally convinced me not only that I like Spider-Man still as a story, but that this one, if you're going to be introduced to one, if there's going to be one every 5 years and you're going to be a 16-year-old kid or a 12-year-old kid who gets introduced to it, this is great. You know, I would trade this for the Tobey Maguire one. I don't know if that's, if you're allowed to say that, but
you're allowed to say anything.
Yeah, it's just like, I actually didn't miss those when I saw this. And I think it's because it's actually kind of a teen movie in a way that, A, we're not really making anymore. I'm not seeing out of Hollywood like a movie with teenagers or at least people pretending to be teenagers.
Right.
So if you underscore the homecoming part of Spider-Man Homecoming, I think you'll walk into this with like a better idea of what you're walking into.
Mm. Yeah. How about you, Thompson?
Yeah, I had much the same reaction as both of you guys. I appreciated the fact that it was a very light on its feet teen movie, that it was a teen comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I also really did appreciate the things that it doesn't bother to include. It doesn't bother to tell you that with great power comes great responsibility. It doesn't bother to have him get bitten by a spider, as you said. And it just focuses largely on dispensing kind of light action and jokes, jokes, jokes. The fact that there are, I think, 6 build screenwriters in this movie portends this kind of committee-driven mess. And yet it feels like all those writers were there just punching up the script. I really enjoyed that. And I think bringing in Michael Keaton as the heavy kind of coming full circle, at one point he's sort of wearing his vulture gear and he looks just like Birdman. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact, like, everybody thought Birdman was Michael Keaton coming full circle. This is Michael Keaton coming full circle. I really just enjoyed this movie enormously.
Interesting. Glenn, how did you feel about the Keaton role? Because I've heard, you know, other people talk about thinking this was a really effective Marvel villain. I found him a little generic.
Well, it's a smart tweaking of the character, because the character is an old man in a vulture suit. He's a different kind of vulture. He's a scavenger. He takes all this alien weaponry and he sells it to the highest bidder, and also uses some of it himself.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I think they do a nice job of undercutting his villainy with certain sympathetic qualities that I think are really useful. And it kind of, for me, harkened back to one of the things I really loved about particularly Spider-Man 2 in the Sam Raimi universe, where you have that wonderful performance by Alfred Molina as Dr. Octopus, who is a supervillain that you care about and sympathize with and understand how he got to this point. And I think that they do a nice job of making Michael Keaton more than just I think he's more than a generic baddie. I think they have nice ways of undercutting that and making him sympathetic.
Yeah. One of the things I think is interesting about the reception to the movie, which has been, you know, in my experience, mostly positive, is that when the first trailers came out, they seemed to be playing up in the trailers the presence of Tony Stark, played by Robert Downey Jr. And in fact, in the movie, that presence is quite light.
Mm-hmm.
But based on the trailers, there were people who were saying it looks like what they've actually done is make an Iron Man movie. And that's not true at all. I will say, when I watched Robert Downey Jr. in this movie, I thought, I don't know that there's as much charm for me in seeing him do some of this as there originally was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's curious to see them decide that essentially the best use of Iron Man, at least in this movie, the best use of Tony Stark slash Iron Man, is to introduce somebody else, somebody new, rather than just doing more Tony Stark Iron Man stuff.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's kind of a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
Iron Man.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
absolutely. I mean, even in this movie, they do play up that angle of him being this billionaire, kind of a corporate shark type who's actually not that great, right? That sets off some of the villainy. And I somewhat appreciate that. And I think that it's a flawed character who you're supposed to root for. And seeing him try to be paternal was sort of amusing mm-hmm. in moments. But, like, I'm not a person who, like, likes Tony Stark as a person in any of these movies. I always think, like, I think we'd all kind of hate him
if
he really existed.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. No question.
But since it's Robert Downey Jr., it's sort of like, ha, ha, ha.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's he's there to sell the movie as much as anything.
He does a good job. I mean, I think one thing I really liked about this movie that by partnering, and Glenn can break this down, the sort of studio partnership of like Sony actually getting to acknowledge the rest of this comic universe, it gets to do something which you also see in the Netflix superhero movies, where they acknowledge a world where superheroes and aliens exist. But on a very small scale, these like kind of small scale local superheroes like Jessica Jones or Luke Cage, they're not involved in all of that, right? They might be solving their little neighborhood hijinks,
right?
But they're not tearing down skyscrapers,
right?
And their friends and relatives will make kind of jokes here and there about, like, I don't know what's going on these days, you know, there's a guy with a hammer out there, like, and I always find that very, I'm always amused by that kind of acknowledgement that, like, yeah, we all can kind of get used to anything if you think about it.
They're not just keeping it grounded, they're keeping it interconnected, which of course is one of the main appeals of the Marvel
it
universe.
It really worked. You know, sometimes I resent it because I'm like, there's so many of these movies and I just feel like this is going to be, you know, the boomers will have their like great cinema and we'll have this and we'll like have to explain this to our kids. But, you know, if when they make little efforts like that that seem like, okay, we have built a world, then I can appreciate that.
This film is actually more attuned to our contemporary society than a lot of other superhero films have been. A, because you've got a villain with a grievance that we've heard a lot. B, because they understand something about nerds, which is it's changed. The world has changed. When Spider-Man was created back in the 60s, Peter Parker was a nerd in a sweater vest who was bullied by Flash Thompson, who was a jock in a Letterman sweater. And when they made the original Tobey Maguire films, they kind of kept that dynamic. And they kind of played with it with the Andrew Garfield dynamic a little bit as well. Here, everybody's at a science tech magnet school because nerds have taken over. And everybody's a nerd. And that is reflected in the film. His bully is played by Tony Revolori, who is not a bully, but a guy who makes fun of him while DJing.
Yeah. So and he was in who you might know from the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yes, exactly. So it's a different world. It's a more contemporary world.
Yeah. One of the things that I like about it is that I think they do a good job of making the movie about what they want it to be about on a larger level, on a kind of a meta macro level, which is Spider-Man joining the Marvel Cinematic Universe. A lot of times that can sound like a marketing thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we're bringing Spider-Man into the Marvel Cinematic Universe so that they can all be part of the same line of plastic cups. but this movie is really about the integration of him into this team and whether it is to happen at all and how it might happen if it were to happen. The other thing I like about it that is related to that is the Marvel movies have a very interesting relationship with the suit, I think. There is the suit that you can make on your own, and there is the suit that is a superhero suit. There's the suit that says, I'm taking this responsibility. And then there's the suit that you get that is the suit you've earned. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And there is there's a version of an early suit in the Captain America movies that inspires his ultimate kind of super suit. There is some great stuff, particularly in Iron Man 3, about him when he has the suit, when he doesn't have the suit. There's a great shot of him dragging the suit. And I think this movie, too, has a really interesting relationship with how it's not just a matter of there's Peter Parker and there's Spider-Man, but there are different ideas of what it means to be a hero. And I think one of the things that they use this integration into the Avengers, whether it's ever going to happen fully or not, I think one of the things they're playing with and one of the ways they convey it is with the costuming stuff, mm-hmm. because you have the one that kind of looks like jammies and then you have the other one.
Mm-hmm. And they're trying to say the person still matters.
Right.
Which I think in a big summer blockbuster where there's just so much computers and machinery and stuff, I think they're trying to make an attempt to say, yeah, we do actually care about the character.
Right.
And in fact, I found the stuff about the character the most interesting and the most exciting. I think mm-hmm. where this movie is the least exciting for me is when a fairy gets sawed in half and he has to stitch it together. And then it feels more like a typical action set piece. Whereas I could just sit and watch his like silly buddy Ned over here wisecracking all day. Like I found the part of it that is a high school comedy actually in ways more exciting than the parts that are a typical superhero film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they know what they're doing in terms of comedy. They have the staff of the school played by Hannibal Buress and Martin Starr, an unrecognizable Martin Starr because he's got an affect in this one. And also Donald Glover figures largely, not largely, but he figures in a way that is perfect and wonderful.
And to that point about Donald Glover, I think this movie makes excellent use of him because he was part of this like controversial discussion about whether or not Spider-Man could be cast as a person of color. He was a name. People had briefly like a social media campaign around him having the role. And at the time, I remember being really kind of annoyed because it seemed like if you're going to have a kid who's essentially like an orphan in Queens and it's New York, like that's not a hard thing to do to make that person a person of color. And I always resented comics fans who acted as though it would be breaking canon to do that.
Right.
I think the movie does a good job of like trying to make up for it, so to speak, in the casting around him. Not just the kids, the fact that they're actually somewhat young, right? They at least remotely could be teenagers recently, and it felt that way in some scenes, especially with extras. But it's a diverse American high school. It felt like a recognizable place.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And even in the Spidey montage where he's solving local crimes, like practicing, there's not that much crime, right? Because let's face it, crime in New York is not what it was when these comics were created.
Yeah.
So he literally has to like try and get back a stolen bike, which isn't really stolen. You know, he's like giving someone directions. Mm-hmm. Like New York is not that crime-ridden place that it was when these comics were created. And I like that the movie acknowledged both the diversity of the city and also the reality of, like, how you would train, you know, to fight crime right now.
Yeah. And I feel like the casting, not just the casting, but also the creation of the high school kids who are around him is a little more interesting than you sometimes get. I really kind of dig the Zendaya performance as this girl named Michelle, who you don't... You don't get a lot of the filling in of her. You get the feeling that a lot of that is meant to happen later. Yeah.
Which, for the actress, this is like her version of doing Monster. Yeah. For Charlize Theron. Like, because she's so glamorous. You can tell she's like, I'm going to wear a ponytail for this one.
But I like her in this. And I also, you know, you mentioned Ned, the friend. To me, Ned is a chubby best friend without being the chubby best friend.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't see him eating all the time.
Right.
You don't see him running, you know, in a way that's meant to be like, oh, look at the kid trying to run. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't treat him differently for that reason.
No, they treat him as an audience surrogate.
It's just that it's part of the, it's just that he's one of the many people you meet in the movie. And I did appreciate that a lot. And we haven't even really talked at all about Tom Holland in this role. And I have pointed this out on Twitter a couple times, and I apologize for being so insufferable about it. But when I saw Tom Holland years ago in The Impossible, which is the movie with Naomi Watts about the tsunami, he was really a young kid. And he's also been a theater kid. He was in Billy Elliot, the musical, and is a song and dance kid. But when I saw him in The Impossible, even though, you know, that is not the lead role in that movie, I looked at that kid and I thought, that is a really interesting kid. He has great, curious, thoughtful eyes, and he has kind of a keenly aware way of being. And I think he does bring some of that to this role, which helps put some meat on the bones of what could otherwise be kind of like a wide-eyed,
and just saying
eager,
gee whiz all the time.
Just saying gee whiz all the time. You do get a really interested, engaged kind of vibe off of him, which I think really helps.
This film feels a lot more like Ant-Man than The Avengers.
Yeah.
And that's intentional.
Yeah. I will be curious to hear what all of you have to say about Spider-Man Homecoming. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH and tell us what you thought about Spider-Man Homecoming, Michael Keaton, Zendaya, Tom Holland, and men who climb up buildings. When we come back, we're going to talk about Tour de Pharmacy, the comedy special from HBO. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the AT&T original series Mr. Mercedes, based on Stephen King's best-selling novel. A demented serial killer taunts a retired police detective, and now the ex-cop must bring the killer to justice before he can strike again. Mr. Mercedes premieres August 9th at 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific on Audience. Watch on DirecTV Channel 239 or stream on DirecTV Now. Go to att.net/Mr. Mercedes for more information.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Andy Samberg got famous as a Saturday Night Live goofball, but since he left the show in 2012, he stayed very busy. He's the lead in the Fox comedy series Brooklyn Nine-Nine, but he's also stayed active, making music and comedy with his troupe, The Lonely Island. Last summer, he starred in the woefully unappreciated.
Not by us. I agree. We appreciate
we
it.
We loved it.
There we go. Satire, pop star, never stop, never stopping. And in 2015, he and writer Murray Miller made the sports mockumentary 7 Days in Hell, a ridiculous and filthy HBO special starring Samberg and Kit Harington from Game of Thrones as rival tennis players. Now Samberg is back with Murray and 7 Days in Hell director Jake Szymanski with a similar HBO project switching the focus to cycling. Tour de Pharmacy is now available on HBO and all your streaming and on-demand platforms, I am sure. And its enormous cast includes Kevin Bacon, Orlando Bloom, Jeff Goldblum, John Cena, David Diggs, and others far too numerous to list. Now, I do want to establish, as you might have heard hinted during that introduction, we really liked Popstar quite a bit. Andy Samberg was not always my cup of tea, and that's partly because on Saturday Night Live, he seemed like Adam Sandler. And his persona post-Saturday Night Live has proved to be, in some cases, a little more sweet
Not just sweet, but smaller.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But this is not the smaller Andy Samberg. No. This is the other. What's not the smaller Andy Samberg? This is the blown
it's
out.
It's the full Samberg.
This is the... yeah, not the full Samberg in this movie, but the full somebody is in this movie.
It's full of many people.
So the basic gist here is it is about a season, a cycling of the Tour de France, where, you know, it's from long ago, so you get the supposed archival footage. That's when you see Andy Samberg and Orlando Bloom and some of those guys. Then you get the modern day interviews, which is where you get some of the other
the talking heads,
casting,
sports,
the talking heads.
Mockumentary part of it.
We're going to spoil here because it's not that much of a spoilable.
And we're just we're spoiling casting.
Exactly. I do think some of the casting jokes are funny, like Jeff Goldblum as grown-up Andy Samberg.
Yep.
I see it a little bit. Dolph Lundgren as grown-up John Cena.
Uh-huh.
I see it. It makes sense to me.
And Danny Glover as the Daveed Diggs, adult version
That's right.
of Daveed Diggs, with a wonderful wig on.
Yes. Yeah. Quite a wig on.
That's all for costume.
You said this was just the big Andy Samberg. I disagree slightly. It goes back and forth because there are so many jokes and they're so all over the map. You get big joke, like there's a Will Forte bit, which is pretty big. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then you get Maya Rudolph, a little aside from Maya Rudolph. Then you get a big John Cena being roided out guy, which I thought was going to be this whole thing. I thought this whole thing was just going to be one steroid joke after
right.
another. John Cena, John Cena, John Cena. But then you get, you cut back to Nathan Fielder.
And yeah.
Every time Nathan Fielder is on the screen, he is my rock. He's just doing nothing. He's just listing all the drugs that are in people's systems. But it is so funny because it's so small. It's so pulled back.
And he plays like the cycling organization drug testing director, right? I don't know this actor at all.
Oh,
so
my God,
I was really delighted
where
by
might,
it.
Where might people know
Nathan For You is a series where he gives people terrible advice and they follow it. The series is more about him and his schlubby affect than it is about his advice. It's very funny.
Part of the fun of Nathan Fielder in this is that he's dry.
Yeah.
There's a lot of very big outward comedy, and to have a little bit of inward comedy really helps.
Yep.
I also just enjoyed the ability and willingness, and this is true both in Tour de Pharmacy and in 7 Days in Hell, of a willingness to just wander off course. And it gives you just this sense overall. If you take 7 Days in Hell and Tour de Pharmacy and put them together, they are not quite a feature-length movie. So the stakes of this thing and the lift of this thing as an audience member are so slight that if there's one joke with full frontal nudity that you don't enjoy, there's another joke with full frontal nudity that you might. And so I just found these things incredibly fun and silly and slight and very fast moving in ways that I got a kick out of it. I mean, what is the hit rate on the jokes? It's not 90%.
No.
Yeah.
It's, you know, even if it's 40%.
Good enough.
It's good enough. It's fun.
I'll take it.
These
to go
days,
back to
yeah.
your point, though, I think the show single-handedly aimed to address the HBO gender imbalance on Full Frontal.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure whether to commend them or really, really object.
You know, I don't care about sports. I think I don't need to restate my position there. And I don't care about the Tour de France. I watched this with friends who are not sporty. Don't care. And they were laughing, and they were laughing, and then something happened. As soon as Lance Armstrong, spoiler, comes
okay,
on screen.
Spoiler, folks.
It's not a spoiler.
It's kind of, right. Well,
he's on in the first 5 minutes.
Their laughter dried up completely.
Yeah.
Every time he came on screen, and I was like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And they were like, that's...
Hashtag too soon.
This is souring me because he cheated, they said. He cheated, and it was just fascinating to me.
It's not that he cheated. I'm going to make an argument here, which is not that he cheated. It's that he cheated. He vehemently denied cheating and really came hard after anybody who said that he did.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he, quote unquote, sort of apologized in a conversation with Oprah, it wasn't a very satisfying apology. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not just the too soon. It's the didn't do the time kind of thing. There's almost a sentence that people expect you to serve, which is you have to fully admit you were wrong and you have to fully acknowledge what you did. And then you have to wait for some time to pass. And then they will be very forgiving. Mm. I think Lance Armstrong has a specific problem public image-wise. And it's almost like his specific problem is exactly the thing that this is meant to address. Like what he wants to do in this movie is say, it's over. Now I'm in on the joke. Everybody likes me again. because several of my critic friends commented on this too. And I think the problem is it feels like a push for absolution for somebody who hasn't done what people expect public figures to do before they can be absolved. Hmm. And that is apologize and acknowledge what they did. I think because he doesn't, people don't feel like he's done the work. They aren't as ready as they might be with other people.
Which is underscored by the presence of a one Mike Tyson.
That's the thing. Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't know if the guys doing the movie knew that and that's what they were trying to show. But Mike Tyson, I'm not going to say he's apologized somewhere because I didn't dig that deep in the Wikipedia page, but he certainly served time for mm-hmm. his various crimes.
Yeah.
But he's also like gone on literal apology tours, done a Broadway show, written multiple books about his past and how he feels about it.
Done lots of stuff making fun of himself.
And lots of stuff making fun of himself.
And there's
but also
still
the
people
thing
who aren't
that,
ready for that either.
Not at all. Not at all. But I'm just saying, like, I was watching this and thinking, Armstrong, you're not even at Tyson levels yet.
Right.
Exactly.
So I don't know who you think you are rolling up in here trying to make a joke now. Okay.
Like, right. I agree.
Do a couple memoirs and maybe I can understand what happened. But that thing you said about him going after people who accused him and who were, you know, unveiling the truth about what was happening, he was vicious. And so the jokes here don't acknowledge anything like that. The joke is just his presence in a movie that's supposed to be a joke about drug use in cycling.
Yeah.
But your presence is not a present. Sorry,
yeah.
Jay-Z would say.
It's interesting.
It feels like a casting coup that
totally.
That
oh, we got him. They're so excited.
Yeah, that threatens to kind of run away with what the show is. And any time it draws away from that and back into bits like Andy Samberg represents the continent of Africa because he's the son of a diamond miner.
Yeah.
Like there's enough other stuff. I do agree that it kind of grinds to a halt with the Lance Armstrong stuff, in part because as an audience member, you're sitting there like, how did they get him to do this?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think there are a bunch of ways you can feel about doping itself, about sort of what the moral components of doping are or not. It's all the other stuff.
Yeah.
And I think if you watch, there's been some documentary work made around him and around cycling. And I think that, you know, I think some of that is hard to watch.
And I didn't mean to imply that Tyson is absolved, especially for some of his more serious crimes.
I know.
The thing you were talking about the time spent in a public redemption mode has just been much longer
longer.
More public than Lance is essentially sorry, not sorry, and then we haven't seen him since.
Right. But Stephen mentioned something else that I also want to talk about, which is the relatively short length of these pieces of 7 Days in Hell and also of Tour de Pharmacy. I do think that this idea of like a 35, 40-minute comedy short film is something that I don't know if we had a good distribution mechanism for that prior to kind of the explosion of cable and all that stuff. And I don't know that there have been a lot of people who have made much out of the idea of the standalone, non-feature-length comedy special, scripted special.
Right.
Sort of functioning like a stand-up special would, except it's a comedy. It's a scripted comedy special.
Yeah, he switched in this from doing kind of what was a twofer with him and Kit Harington in the tennis thing to really an ensemble piece. Mm-hmm. He's in this, but he doesn't dominate.
Right, no, that's true.
I'm talking about Andy Samberg now.
Right.
And because he's busy, right? But all these people are busy, and they all kind of come in, do a thing, and then they're out of the filmette.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to me of a certain kind of a brand of restraint that I appreciate, because if this one joke was an hour and a half.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Oui.
And how many times have you seen that? How many times have you seen
absolutely.
Something where the first 20 minutes of a funny thing are funny, and then it's clear that that's all there is?
Mm-hmm.
It's clear that they ran out of, like, they had a funny idea, and the only thing to do with your funny idea, if it's not going to be a series, is to make a feature film. So they wind up making an entire feature film, you know, because it'll be like, oh, what if Michael Cera and Jack Black were cavemen? And instead of being able to make like a half hour thing, they make Year One, which is feature length and bleh.
God bless you for remembering that.
Hey, I went to
I
a screening
like,
of that.
To the smartphones, because I have no idea what you're talking about.
I am going to ring that experience out until I've gotten every drop of value because I spent that hour and a half of my life.
Well, maybe
anyway.
It's Sandberg leaning into his strengths, because if his strengths on SNL, right, it's the digital short. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So much of this felt like a bunch of digital shorts thrown together,
right.
Especially those digressions people are talking mm-hmm. about, which are very funny. But also, it felt like that moment at Saturday right. Night Live when you're like, all right, now we're going to just see a silly thing for, you know, 2 minutes.
Yeah. It's the, I can't remember where I read about it. It might have been in a book about SNL, but they talk about the concept of dropping the cow, which is just you get to the end of a sketch, and even if you don't have an ending, you just drop a cow on the whole thing, and then it's over. Just because nobody has anything else to do, and so often you wish they would drop the cow sooner.
That explains so much about that program. You need to bookmark that for me.
Like I said, I got to look up where I got it from. Yeah. But
so cow droppings.
Yeah. Tour de Pharmacy is available on all of your HBO streaming services, and we'll be interested to hear what you think about it. Find us on Facebook or on Twitter. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes healthy cooking easy. They send pre-measured ingredients that are organic and non-GMO, along with easy-to-follow directions directly to your door. So you can skip the grocery store and still prepare meals in just 30 minutes. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, lean and clean, and vegetarian options. Sunbasket has meals to fit every busy lifestyle. Listeners get 50% off their first order at sunbasket.com/happy hour.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Last week, for the first time in 4 years, we got a new song by one of my favorite bands, Rye, spelled R-H-Y-E. Kind of a, just like a sexy soul band, but just very restrained and quiet and pretty, lots of pianos, very subtle. And what I love, the song's called Please, and it's gorgeous. Actually, let's hear a little bit of it now. Rye is led by a guy named Mike Miloche, and his specialty, I think, has come to be these very intimate, very warm, very pretty soul songs that are kind of, they feel like they're by and for the already coupled. So the songs aren't necessarily like these big, grandiose statements of seduction so much as like, you're tired, I'm tired. Huh? And I think
Stephen's like, my kind of seduction.
And I think that is the kind of, there is something to that kind of songwriting that is filling a niche, that like so much songwriting is about like attaining love, and these songs are about retaining love. And I think that's cool, and they're also sexy and beautiful. I also just love the music. Like, it's just gorgeously produced. So anyway, the return of Rye after 4 very long years with a gorgeous song called Please.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Often of a summer, NPR Books will do a reader's poll. They've done mystery, they've done science fiction, they've done name your favorite romance. This year, we're not doing a genre, we're doing a medium. And that medium is something I know a little bit about, comics and graphic novels. Now, this project is really Petra Mayer's, and I'm sort of helping out on it. But we asked people to tell us their favorite comics or graphic novel, and the list is pleasantly weird and idiosyncratic. We were worried, the judging panel, and I served on the judging panel, that it would turn out to be the usual suspects, the usual NPR suspects, your Mouse, Persepolis, Fun Home, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, spoiler, guess what? They're on there. But when you ask people to name their favorite, you're not asking them the best. You're not asking them the mm-hmm. most important or influential. You're asking them a very personal thing, and that's what showed up on the list. Now, the judging panel consisted of me, another NPR book critic, Telka Lahosky, Maggie Thompson? How would you say that?
There's an umlaut.
There's an umlaut.
Oh, gosh.
The great Spike Trotman from Iron Circus and somebody named G. Willow Wilson. And it was a great discussion because we got to kind of balance out the list a little bit and fill in some stuff that we love that didn't get... Because when you ask somebody today their favorites, you're not going to get some of the old classics. You're going to get new favorites, which makes the list a great vehicle for finding new stuff. There's a lot of webcomics on here. So if you're looking to see something and get a good recommendation, just check out the Summer Readers Poll on comics and graphic novels on NPR Books right now.
Nice. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon.
Can I ask something? Is it helpful if you don't know much about this world? Do you feel like it's a good introduction list?
Well, I had to write 50, 200-word blurbs about different comics, and Petra wrote the other 50, and we endeavored to make those things a little bit more approachable, a little explaining, A, what this is. You know, summarize 75 years of comics.
I'm in. I mean, if you've done the work, I'm in.
Yeah, no, it is. It's everything that's on the list had to kind of justify its presence. There was a lot of back and forth on the judging panel. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Audie Cornish, what is making you happy this week?
I'm bringing two news articles, womp womp, but they're two pieces of entertainment criticism that I liked in the last couple of days. One is from The Hollywood Reporter. It's by the author's Tim Goodman. It's called The Post-Review, Post-Premiere, Post-Finale World of Peak TV. Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of writing about Peak TV. What I like about this is it explores the idea of, like, what does this mean for the criticism and writing that is out there? We often run into this problem doing the show, even today, where we're like, spoiler, not a spoiler, is a thing, not a thing, it's on streaming, not sure. What does a finale mean when everything might be dropped all at once? Right. Handmaid's Tale kind of tried to take a different tact on Hulu by not dropping it all at once. And it just, I think for people who are into the TV that's out there now and also sometimes feel not just overwhelmed by it, but overwhelmed by the writing about it. Mm-hmm. It was a nice little attempt to get your arms around what's happening in this moment. So that is at The Hollywood Reporter. And the second article is called In the Age of Streaming TV, Who Needs Title Sequences? And this was at The Verge. The author is Lance Richardson. It's not a very long article, but it gets at the idea of, like, why don't we get rid of the opening title sequence? Like, who needs a theme song? Who needs any of this stuff in an age when you might be binge watching television? And then, of course, I thought of all the shows that I watch where that little song, like House of Cards is a great example of a really beautiful opening sequence, a show that no one watches but me and Glenn, Sense8, poured a lot of money into creating its title sequence. I watched The Night Manager 2 years behind everyone else. It has a beautiful opening title sequence, which I think might have been done by the same people who do Westworld. And we have, it's a little bit like cover art on music, right? People are still actually putting some effort into cover art. And it did make me wonder, like, why do we need this? And the author explores and actually interviewed some showrunners about making that call, making that decision, and some who actually tried to get rid of it in place of the title card, which we see sometimes, which is just name of the show.
It's a thing from Lost, where it goes,
and then that's it. You're in it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was In the Age of Streaming TV, Who Needs Title Sequences at The Verge.
Wonderful. My happy is going to be very fast because then I have a little bit of show news to catch you up on. My happy, one of the first things that I talked about in an early episode of the show as something making me happy this week was a website called Budget Bites, where I was getting a lot of really good recipes, one of which is dragon noodles, which many people have told me since then that they made. So one of the things making me happy this week is that Budget Bites has an app. So go out and find it. I have downloaded it and am in the process of trying it. It has some of her recipes. She talks you through it. It's Budget Bites, obviously, B-Y-T-E-S, and I recommend it. So some show news. Next week, you're going to hear a little bit of a format change in the show. And what we're doing, it is, spoiler alert, not either more or less show, but rather than the entire show with two topics and what's making us happy coming out once a week, we're going to have two episodes a week. One will be one topic, one will be the other topic, and what's making us happy this week, which will still be on Friday. Now, what this means for you, if you have a routine that you like, where you like to hear two topics and a what's making us happy on Friday, you can still just listen to them both on Friday. Nothing need really change for you. But hopefully this is going to allow us to be a little bit more timely, and we hope to be able to use more different fourth chairs. And for a bunch of reasons, we're going to try this for a while and see how it works. And so, as I said, if you like the show the way that you get it now, you can always still listen to both on Friday, but we're going to be coming to you twice a week starting next week. So you don't have to change anything about your podcast feed. You don't have to do anything different. But let us know what you think. Again, we are on Facebook. You can always come and find us there. Let us know what you think on Twitter. The only thing I'm going to tell you about the long, boring meetings about this kind of thing, which you don't need to know about, is I give you my word. These are this was done to try to make the show work better for more people. There's nothing nefarious or gross about it. So let us know what you think. We really want to know how it works for you and how it's going to work for us. And we hope that it's going to make it a better show that fits better into your schedule and all that stuff. So that will be happening starting next week. So expect to hear an episode in only the next few days as you hear this. How exciting. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C, Steven at I Dislike Steven, Glenn at GH Weldon, Audie at NPR Audie, our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica _ Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.